Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. How many times have you come upon a news story that made you think that technology was outpacing our ability as a society to deal with it, either on a social level or a legal level or even just a personal level? Do you care if anybody reads what you post online? Do you post things online that you would not want your boss or your reverend to read? And what happens to all of that stuff anyway? Well, a couple of MTSU professors have done some research into what they call the innovation policy vacuum, and they're going to take into account both laws and social norms. Dr. Jeff Clark and Dr. Leanne Clark, who happens to be his daughter-in-law, are our guests today, and we'll be back to talk about this fascinating subject after we hear a few enlightening words from MTSUnews.com.
Here are a few of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. MTSU Athletics and Lightning's Locker Room are joining forces for Operation Hat Trick, a nonprofit movement to provide free headgear to wounded military veterans. Hats are available now at MTSUtees.com and at MTSUtees off-campus location at 910 Ridgely Road. Students who want to explore how life has changed in post-Iron Curtain Europe can sign up for a unique MTSU study abroad experience. During the course entitled Cross-Cultural Perspectives in Leisure and Tourism, participants will learn about tourism development in the Czech Republic and Poland. And an MTSU professor's work to document thousands of years of human history buried along the Cumberland River leads the latest edition of MTSU Magazine. Editor Drew Rubel followed Dr. Tanya Perez and her students as they scoured the prehistoric sites uncovered in the aftermath of the May 2010 Nashville Basin flood. For MTSU News Anytime, go to MTSUnews.com.
Dr. Jeff Clark is Professor of Information Systems in the Department of Computer Information Systems at the Jennings A. Jones College of Business, and the corresponding author of their research paper is his daughter-in-law, Dr. Leanne Clark, who is an assistant professor of management in the Department of Management and Marketing, and she also happens to be a lawyer. Welcome to both of you. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Jenna.
Jeff, what is the overarching theme of this research, if you had to describe the abstract to somebody?
Well, clearly it's the case that we can do things, we have the capacity to do things that we perhaps ought not to do. But the question is, where does the information for ought come from? For example, Google, we're all enjoying the benefits of Google Maps, and we like to place into our GPS or our handheld devices or telephones and look up somebody's address, and it can even show us pictures of what it is that we're about to come to. But in order to get there, Google had to capture that data, had to capture that information. Largely here in the United States, we're pretty comfortable with, like, okay, they did it, but so what? I get to use it. But around the world, everybody's not that equally comfortable. Let me give you an example. Suppose you decide to sunbathe in the nude in your backyard behind a fence.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a reasonable right to the expectation of privacy? And I think most people would feel, you know, pretty upset if some voyeur, you know, posted a ladder by the fence and climbed up and began to take pictures of you and posting them to Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have little difficulty with that. On the other hand, suppose you decided to sunbathe nude in the front lawn and you lived on Main Street in Murfreesboro and there was no fence. We'd probably say you're crazy if you think you have a right to privacy there. Folks are going to walk down the sidewalk and say, look, there's somebody sunbathing nude.
You'd have a right to an attorney, but that'd be about it.
Yeah, exactly. But suppose someone decides to capture information, sometimes called street view, and they decide to drive down the street in a van. But in order to capture the information, they drive down the street in a van, and they place a camera, not out the window of the van, but on a pole on top of the van.
Tall enough to see over the fence where you presumably could sunbathe in the nude.
Exactly. So the question is, do you have a reasonable right to an expectation of privacy if someone, Google, for example, were to drive down your street capturing street view information with a camera posted to the top of a van? Now, if we had a just an ordinary citizen drive down the street with the camera on top of the van as if they were trying to peer into folks' private lives, they would probably have a court appointment.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're Google, what are you supposed to do?
But what's the difference between the Google lens on top of the car, 5 to 7 feet up, being able to peer over into somebody else's fence, and a member of the paparazzi using a telephoto lens from a distance to capture pictures of a celebrity or something, when in neither case are they actually on the person's property, so they're not mm-hmm. trespassing. And yet, how can one be considered a legitimate business interest and the other not be considered a legitimate business interest?
Which is essentially the kinds of questions that provoked our research. And rather than pass judgment on Google or Apple or Facebook or just name it, anybody that's in the popular contemporary media, rather than say they've crossed the line, they should have known better, we've tried to address the question of how do you know what you're supposed to do? Are there laws? Are there cultural standards? Are there hypernorms? Should you just know this? Should you just know this because you just know it? And particularly in, I would say in the U.S., there's an argument that says, well, an organization, a company, ought to do whatever it can do in order to maximize shareholder wealth. And they may even have a fiduciary responsibility that says we didn't do all we could do, as long as it's not against the law. There's even a prevailing sentiment in some sectors in the United States that says that if you can violate the law but increase shareholder wealth, so long as the penalty is not criminal, it's just civil, then go for it. I mean, as long as you don't get in a lot of trouble, break the law because we make more money. So what we're trying to address is really, if rather than just say, no, bad people, you shouldn't do that, we're trying to say, how would you, as a multinational corporation dealing in the information marketplace, how would you know what you should do? And one of the things that we picked up on a lot, and Leanne has a lot of background in the law, has a law degree, and she dwelt a lot on what we would call the comparative law. Turns out what we think you ought to do in the United States is not what they think you ought to do in Germany, for example.
And you made a comparison between the way Google has handled the situation in Germany and the way it has handled the situation in the United States, right, Leanne?
Yes, we did. And when I started this research in this area, I thought in America we probably have some very restrictive privacy laws just because we're all about individual freedom. But when I started this research, I was surprised to find that really our privacy laws are very little. But in the European Union, they have some pretty strict privacy laws, and Germany probably has the strictest out there. They look at personal data as belonging to the person, and a person has to consent to the use of that data. So even a photograph taken on a public street, it is my image that you're using. So in Germany, the norm is I should consent to the use of that taking of the picture and the use of that data before it's ever even used.
How long have the German and European Union statutes been on the books?
The European Privacy Directive was passed in 1995, and that is the law that is having the greatest impact around the globe as we all work together. They require the United States companies or any company working with a European company, a EU company, to protect privacy in that manner. Now, in Germany, though, their first privacy law went back to 1970, and they've had a series of laws since then.
With regard to the European Union, I find this to be kind of interesting. With regard to Great Britain, it's kind of a point-counterpoint thing, because in Great Britain, they have public cameras posted at various places in the major cities, in London and everywhere. As a matter of fact, that was how terrorist suspects were caught several years ago. And they have sort of a surveillance society in place there. And yet, as a counterpoint to that, even though they're members of the European Union, they have to adhere to the European Union standards for privacy rights.
That is correct. The Privacy Directive, though, also applies to private companies. It has a lot to do with how long you store the data, the use of that data. Is it for a legitimate purpose? So in your example there, it's probably that the surveillance, they have deemed that to be for a legitimate purpose. And I'm guessing they're not storing that information for too long.
And they're not using it for commercial use.
Right. So if it's done by a governmental entity, it's okay then?
Not necessarily. In Germany, where a big outrage started was Germany was going to do a census. And people saw that as a, you know, you're surveilling us. And given their history in Germany with Hitler and having every moment that people, you know, everything that they did was watched and monitored, they are very, very sensitive to being data being collected and then being surveilled.
The Nazi regime, as we know from history, was very anal retentive about its documentation. And one can only shudder to think what the Nazis would have done if they had had digital technology available to them in the 1930s and 1940s. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be back with more on this subject on MTSU On the Record right after this.
Women in Science and Engineering, or WISE, helps college women prepare for and become involved in science-related careers. WISE nurtures women's interest in these fascinating and critical fields and provides mentoring and networking opportunities. The group's main goal is to assure women of their importance in all scientific and technical fields and to promote equal opportunity and treatment of women in science. I'm Dr. Judith Iriarte-Gross, WISE advisor.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking about the right to privacy in the digital era and the research of Dr. Jeff Clark and Dr. Leanne Clark. We were talking about the comparison between the U.S. and Germany with regard to how Google handled privacy regulations in each country. So even in Germany, Google did not anticipate the public reaction. They didn't get out ahead of it. They waited until they went ahead and did what they thought would advance their business interest. And then only when the public feedback was so strong did they backtrack and revise their policies and methods.
Which is something we're attempting to say to the commercial community. Perhaps you know what the law is, but you need to know what the norms are and the hypernorms, because maybe you don't have to go to jail or maybe you don't have to pay a fine. But there are people saying, whoa, that's not okay. And so you may suffer some public relations consequences, which may cost you in the long run even more than a civil fine. So we're really concerned that companies, I mean, we're talking about really right now the United States and the EU, and then we're sort of focusing within the EU on Germany. This covers a lot of the world's commerce, but by no means all of it. So what do you do as a multinational corporation today? How do you go forward? How do you navigate all of these paths, most of which literally are not yet marked?
Explain the use of the word hypernorm and how it is different from norm or social norm, the term social norm.
Sure. I guess to step back, a norm is a principle or right that defines what the right action is to do. And it very much shapes people's behavior. Now, often norms become laws. So we take what we believe is the right thing to do and we pass a law. Or it could become formal policy. The government issues some formal statement. But there are a lot of things that guide our behavior that are informal norms. They're unspoken norms or they're cultural norms. And we just know that that's the way you do things. A hypernorm is one of those norms of the right thing to do something that applies to everyone, every human being.
Pedophilia is wrong all the time, absolutely, ever. Just
correct.
For an example.
Correct. Right to life. You don't have a right to come take my life. Now, we do have some exceptions. But in general, if I'm walking down the street, you don't have the right to keep me from living. And privacy, and looking at this, there is arguments that privacy or some piece of privacy is such a hyper norm that all humans need some time to be left alone. That's one way that people define privacy. Or we need some ability to protect our thoughts and what we do.
Which itself is an interesting point for an argument. Is privacy a hyper norm? I mean, should we assume that you have some reasonably legitimate right to privacy that you just ought to have just because you're alive, period?
Because you're a sentient being.
Yeah.
You're a human being.
And most people would say, well, yeah, of course. But then whenever you sort of start applying it, most people, or a lot of people, are actually willing to exchange those privacy rights for matters of personal convenience.
For example, if you get a Twitter account, and Twitter has signed an agreement with the Library of Congress that everything that's posted on Twitter from the inception of the business gets to go into the Library of Congress archives. Have you voluntarily sacrificed your privacy rights just by signing up to be on a Twitter account?
Just because you want to be on Twitter, exactly.
Yeah.
And whenever I use my Google Maps, which I do, in spite of the fact that it troubles me that Google reads my mail, my email.
Mm-hmm.
When I use my Google Maps, it's like, I really wish they wouldn't do all the things they do, but I really need to know how to find this address right now. And they're darn good at it. And if I got any questions, they'll actually even show me a picture of the building I'm trying to go into.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I have rights to privacy. I believe I have rights to privacy. But I fairly routinely surrender my rights to privacy in exchange for something they give me. But the exchange is sort of tacit. I mean, it's not like we have a conversation and say, we're going to do this now. This really began for me around the whole issue of the role of Google's interaction with Gmail accounts, which is virtually ubiquitous now.
Right.
Many, I know as a professor, I send almost as many emails to students with gmail.com as I do mtsu.edu extensions. And it's popular now to use Google Docs, and we deposit all of our information there. But we need to understand that Google reads our mail.
Do you think that we as a society even have a totally clear understanding of the fact that you think a communication in cyberspace, whether it's your cell phone or texting on your cell phone or posting something on the web or email, we still think of it as a private communication like a telephone conversation that hasn't been tapped yet, when in fact that's not the case?
Certainly there's that disinformation that's out there. And then when we try to infer from that to a larger picture, we never believed that when it was just the Bell companies or whatever managing our local landline telephone, we never had any conceptualization that somebody was recording that, storing it, and using some sort of a bot, we would call it, some sort of a detection device to go through and see what have we been talking about. But that is in fact happening in our Gmail account. And one of the popular illustrations for that I've not personally encountered would be you have a Gmail account and you've talked about someone in your family who has passed away and you're going to a funeral. And then you begin to notice that the advertisement popping up around you is for flowers.
Mm-hmm.
This is going on. This is there. Now, I don't want to say I don't want to be the person who's saying wrong. This is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
What we're saying is that there's a policy vacuum. There are things we can do that we maybe don't think we should do.
If we choose to codify them, we can as a society.
We could choose to do them or choose to not do them, but we're in the process of undergoing one of the largest paradigm shifts in our civilization's history, the transformation from the industrial age to the information age. Decades from now, when school children read about this, this will be as transforming as the agri age to the industrial age. Right? We're on this dividing line. We haven't recreated yet the rules for the new world. And there is a sense in which we really shouldn't hold, in my opinion, the companies accountable if we as a society have not stepped up and said, we haven't decided yet about this.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there's another side of me that says, you know what? They just ought to know better.
Yeah.
There are things that they just ought to know better than to do. Driving down my street with a 7-foot camera on top of the van just doesn't smell right. It flunks the smell test.
But should we kick ourselves in the butt too much? I mean, after all, I doubt that when Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone that he had that he could have anticipated the obscene phone call, if you know what I mean. I mean, how could he possibly know that people would take advantage of his wonderful invention mm-hmm. to horrify somebody else?
Right. And the law will never be able to keep pace with where innovation is going, especially at this pace. There's no way that we can keep passing laws that will stay ahead of where we're headed. That's why, I guess, in this paper, we strongly said to companies, you've got to look at the cultural norms because they are there. They don't change very quickly. Although Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg recently said that the norm for online privacy has changed over a period of 5 years. And that is something that I would like to study because I guess I don't buy that it has changed that quickly, but I think it's to his advantage that they've changed.
Yeah, I mean, he is asserting, in other words, that people are less or more willing to yield their privacy rights than they were 5 years ago.
Yes. Facebook is an amazing company. I think it is doing amazing things. It's changing how we communicate. It's allowing places where they can't communicate still to get the word out and protest. I think it's an amazing communication tool. And I think we should recognize it, like the telephone, that it has revolutionized how we communicate. And with the telephone, we do have laws, norms in place that says you're not supposed to eavesdrop on my conversation. Mm-hmm. Now, in online settings, we don't seem to have those same, I guess, laws in place or expectations. And that's what he's saying. In the online environment, people, I guess we just assume that our information is out there for anybody to use.
We'll have more on this fascinating topic after a quick break. This is MTSU On the Record.
The Middle Tennessee State University Women's Studies Research Series features compelling monthly talks on gender-related topics by faculty and graduate students. The series offers a chance to learn about research in progress and to chat with faculty in an informal setting. All lectures are free and open to the public and are held on the MTSU campus. This is Associate Professor of Journalism, Dr. Jane Marcellus.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking about the right to privacy in the digital age with Dr. Jeff Clark and Dr. Leanne Clark. Is the reason that our cultural norm is not the same as Germany's cultural norm with regard to this issue, Germany's Nazi history notwithstanding, that in our Constitution, the bedrock law of the land, we don't really have an explicit right to privacy outlined in so many words?
You are correct. We don't have a right to privacy outline clearly in our Constitution. There have been some Supreme Court cases through the years that have kind of gotten to an implied right of privacy, but nothing recently that has protected that. Really, in the U.S., you have to look to common law in each state for some sort of privacy protection. And through the years, we have four basic privacy torts spelled out, but it would be very much dependent on individual court cases to define what that is.
And our call is really a call to a conversation that we need to say, you know, we need to talk about this and decide, how then shall we live? How are we going to live with this particular technology?
And we shouldn't do it in a knee-jerk or willy-nilly fashion either, because as you just implied, when you open up certain doors, there can be unintended consequences mm-hmm. down the road. So the businesses or the business people to whom you are talking should take as many factors as they possibly can mm-hmm. into consideration when they're having this dialogue or this discussion.
Yeah, I find that when you first mention this to people in a conversation, they're like, no big deal. Pretty quickly, you discover that they get pretty fascinated with it. As a case in point, what we call opt-out, opt-in. Generally speaking, in the United States, if you go buy something and it's online and you don't want communication from the company, mm-hmm. you are expected to opt out.
Right.
like the default is we're going to contact you, or we may sell your information or whatever and whatever and whatever. But if I don't want it to happen, I have to opt out. In many countries of the world, it's the opposite. The default is we're not going to bug you. We're not going to distribute, sell, or whatever. You have to opt in. And when I do that simple illustration to people and say, do you think we ought to opt out or opt in? They said, well, I sure wish I could opt in, because I hated that one of the things every time I, do an inquiry online about something, I know that it's just going to open me up to an email box full of sales inquiries and who knows what all else. But we have an opt-out presumption, whereas, frankly, most of the rest of the world has an opt-in presumption. So I'm not sure that the typical U.S. citizen realizes how far we have already compromised our privacy rights compared to the rest of the world.
And the opt-out option as opposed to the opt-in option, American business, it seems to me, tends to do that because they are anticipating that if you go for a 10-day free trial or a 30-day free trial of a product or service or whatever, and unless you just absolutely hate it, it's going to slip your mind, and the automatic you just bought the one-year contract is going to kick in, even though you know that it's in the fine print that if you don't tell them you don't want this service on a paid basis, then you've bought it anyway.
Well, and I know there are a lot of people that's even listening right now that have gotten really frustrated wanting to throw their computer through the window when they just wanted to get off somebody's list. I think the United States ought to have an opt-out, opt-in conversation.
One more brief break. We'll be back in just a second on MTSU on the Record.
The MTSU Educational Talent Search, or METS, reaches out to students in grades 6 through 12 in Coffee, Grundy, and Warren counties. We provide youngsters who have college potential with educational and financial aid counseling and guide them as they determine their educational and career goals. More than 95% of Educational Talent Search students graduate from high school and more than 79% enroll in post-secondary education. This is METS Coordinator Debbie Frisbee. To find out more, go to WMOT.org and click on PSA.
Dr. Jeff Clark and Dr. Leanne Clark are our guests today. What fills the gap in the meantime? Are there any court precedents whatsoever? I mean, you said there weren't very many cases, but when I hear the words right to privacy, I think of the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision, but that was pertaining to abortion and a woman's right to privacy within her own body.
You could look at the individual common law cases, but we're also saying, though, look at the meaning behind that law. So even though a law in the case you brought up, the spirit of that was protecting something within the woman's body. Mm-hmm. Just like I have thoughts within my head, the spirit of that law is there are things within us that are within our own control and body, and they're not for someone else to use. So I think you can pull from what is out there to help provide guidance. You also have to look at industry standards. Now, this is global or global market at this point. So I think you look to what other countries are doing. And when there are more countries out there that are protecting data or limiting its use or doing the opt-in approach, I think that says something to our companies that's guidance to how we should act. In that area, the U.S., since we don't have these privacy laws in place like the European Union, we've entered into a safe harbor agreement, which says that companies have to say that they're doing certain things to do business with people in the European Union or to use data from those companies over there. So that in itself is also providing guidance of how it should be.
Doesn't the consumer have to be equally diligent and equally vigilant about protecting his or her own right to privacy in the absence of any sort of a uniform standard?
And I think that you've hit the nail right on the head there, Jenna. We have a relatively unempowered consumer base, I think, in the U.S. When I say we could actually decide to be an opt-in rather than an opt-out society, they say, I didn't know that was a question we could answer. I didn't know that was something we could do. We just think this just happens to us, and it just happens. But we could certainly have a more powerful consumer voice. We certainly need to have a more informed consumer voice. We need to know the price we're paying for the conveniences we're gaining.
Dr. Jeff Clark, Dr. Leanne Clark, both in the Jennings A. Jones College of Business here at MTSU, thank you so much for sharing your research with us today. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Jenna.
Thank you.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.